Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the work of adolescence, and why does it seem to start earlier and end later today than for previous generations? Recent science has revealed the years of adolescence to be a time of truly astonishing brain development, rivaling the first 3 years of life. Any adult who's spent much time with teenagers knows that their enviably sharp minds are still susceptible to impulsive choices, hypersensitivity, and the effects of peer pressure. But as my guest today will explain, there are risks but also benefits to the unique processes of the adolescent brain. And the better we understand that, the better we can help guide their development into healthy, independent adults. Lawrence Steinberg is Distinguished University Professor of Psychology at Temple University and author of the new book, Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. He joins us as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. Larry, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much. I'm really looking forward to this.
It is fascinating to think that brain development continues well beyond the end of childhood and into the 1920s. How did we start to understand that?
We began learning more about brain development with the advent of brain imaging technologies. Until not all that long ago, I think many people thought that the brain stopped developing when we were 11 or 12 years old because that's about the age at which it reaches its adult size. But there's a lot still changing inside the brain that you can't see just by looking at it with the naked eye. Once fMRI technology became available, researchers began doing brain scans of individuals in the adolescent period and found that patterns of brain anatomy and activity were continuing to change throughout adolescence and into the early 20s.
And while culture might affect the expressions of adolescent impulsivity, it turns out that patterns of behavior are fairly universal across cultures.
Yeah, we've been doing a study of about 5,000 people between the ages of 10 and 30 in 12 different countries, countries that range quite considerably in terms of their levels of development. So very wealthy ones like Sweden and very poor ones like Kenya or Jordan. And the pattern of development of things like impulse control looks remarkably similar across these very different types of environments that kids live in. So there's gradual improvement in impulse control throughout adolescence and into the decade of the 20s, and we see that around the world.
So here's something that's interesting. There may be an adult level of intelligence by the time young people reach their late teens, but there are other processes that are still developing. Can you explain how those things are different, even though they may not feel different to us?
Sure. So the prefrontal cortex of the brain, the area right behind your forehead, is the brain's CEO, and it's responsible for all of our advanced thinking abilities, so things like decision-making and planning. It also happens to be responsible for self-control. The prefrontal cortex is pretty much fully mature by the time people are 15 or 16 years old. And you see that if you give people tests of basic intellectual abilities and you don't see any improvement in performance after age 15 or 16. But after that age, what happens is that the connections between the prefrontal cortex and other parts of the brain continue to mature and continue to develop. And what that helps with are processes that involve the coordination of thinking and feeling, of thought and emotion. So the ability to think before we act, particularly in an emotionally arousing situation, continues to develop even after what we call cold cognition is mature by age 15 or 16.
Yeah, you talk about hot and cold decision-making, and they are two very different things, even if they are about issues that are equally important.
Right. So if we do studies and we compare the thinking of adolescents and adults under ideal circumstances, so when people are not emotionally aroused, when they're alone, when they're relaxed, there aren't very many differences between 15-year-olds and adults. But if we change the circumstances and make people very emotional, or just by putting peers in the room with them, not even having them pressure them, but just being around them, we start to see big age differences in the way that people make decisions in these emotionally arousing circumstances. And we refer to that as hot cognition. So when we talk about whether adolescents think as well as adults, the answer is complicated, and it really depends on the circumstances under which we're measuring their thinking abilities.
So in other words, they might be able to responsibly choose who they want to be the next governor, but we might want to have them hold off on getting behind the wheel of the family SUV.
Right. So one of the issues I take on in the book is how we should use lessons from the science of adolescence to inform where we draw age boundaries under the law. I've been very active in the last 15 years in the application of brain science to decisions about how we treat kids who violate criminal law and how we punish them. But, you know, when we are looking at cold cognitive decisions like voting or giving informed consent for medical treatment, I don't see any reason why young people shouldn't be allowed to make those decisions on their own when they're 16 years old. But when we look at hot cognition, like when you're driving, let's say, or when you're in the midst of a criminal act, I think we really need to treat adolescents and adults differently, even at the age of 18.
One of the things I think that gets people hung up on issues like that, particularly where it comes to criminal justice, is people say, well, at that age, I was, you know, out on my own. I had a job. I was doing something. And these young people ought to be where I was at the time. And you have some pretty strong feelings about this.
You know, I think we can't help but compare the development of people of a certain age to the way that we were when we were that age. We see this a lot today when parents are looking at young adults in their early and mid-20s who are still sort of finding their way in terms of a career or settling into a permanent romantic relationship. And the timetable for doing those adult things has shifted. People are doing it much later than was the case a generation ago. So if you look at 25-year-olds today, for instance, they're twice as likely to still be students as their parents' generation was at that age, and they're only half as likely to be married, and they're 50% more likely to be receiving financial assistance from their parents. Now, I think that there has been a tendency of adults to look at those kinds of data and say, you see, the current generation of 20-somethings are a bunch of self-absorbed slackers who are just taking their time becoming adults because they want to. But in fact, I think it's the economy that has driven that, because in order to get a decent paying job today, you need to have a college degree. It's no longer adequate to just have a couple of years of college. You need to actually graduate from college. And what we refer to as a four-year degree now on average takes 6 years to complete. So we're really looking at a very, very long period of schooling that people need to be engaged in order to be competitive in the labor force. So, of course, it if you think about it that way, it comes as little surprise that people are following a timetable that is nowhere nearly as accelerated as the timetable that their parents followed.
Of course, as you point out in the book, this extended adolescence, at least in the United States, is in many ways a privilege afforded to middle and upper middle class youths whose parents have the resources to continue raising them at an age when lower income young people might have to be out on their own.
It is. And I make the argument in the book that I think that this elongation of adolescence, as I hope we get to discuss it a little bit, just starts earlier as well as lasts longer, that the elongation of adolescence has disproportionately disadvantaged children from poor families. Because in order to stick it out in school for as long as people need to stick it out today, you need the resources to be able to do it and the support from your family to be able to do it. But you also need to have a very strong ability to delay gratification, and that requires a lot of self-control. What we know now is that because of poor prenatal nutrition and exposure to harsh environments early in life, that children who were born into disadvantaged families come into the world with a neurobiological disadvantage. Their prefrontal cortical development is not as healthy, and it doesn't have the advantages that middle-class children have because of the differences between the schools and the neighborhoods and the communities that kids grow up in. So in today's world, being a poor person is even worse for your chances of success in life than it had been a generation ago.
We know that rates of early puberty are on the rise. What are the emotional implications of beginning puberty and thus beginning adolescence sooner than earlier generations?
I think there are several. One of the things I think that we're just beginning to understand is how the brain is affected by being exposed to sex hormones. And it turns out that the sex hormones that increase at puberty do more than just arouse our libido or change the way our bodies look. They actually affect the brain in some very profound ways. One thing that they do is they make the brain more plastic, which is why adolescence is a second period of heightened brain plasticity. But another thing that they do is they intensify our experience of pleasure. They do that by increasing activity in the brain of a neurotransmitter called dopamine. Dopamine is the neurotransmitter that's the most important one for our experience of reward or pleasure. And there's more dopamine activity in the brain's reward centers during adolescence than at any other point in development. And that's because of the impact of puberty on the brain. What that means emotionally and behaviorally is that nothing ever feels as good as it does during adolescence. It never feels as good again as it does during adolescence. But because good things feel so much better during adolescence, this often impels kids to do risky and reckless things in the pursuit of a reward or a new sensation, even if there are dangers that are present. So earlier puberty means the earlier onset of risky and reckless behavior.
Is there something different about the adolescent brain that causes young people to be more sensitive to the possibility of reward and less concerned about the punishment or consequence that might come with this risky choice?
Yes, there is. If you put people in a brain scanner and you show them pictures of rewarding stimuli, so let's say pictures of smiling faces, or if they're playing some kind of a gambling game, pictures of coins, what you see is you get a much bigger brain activation in adolescence than you do in children or in adults. There's a lot of research now indicating that adolescents generally are more reward sensitive than adults are, or than younger children are. And this makes adolescents pay more attention to the potential rewards in their environment and pay consequently less attention to the potential downside of the decisions that they make.
What might be the evolutionary basis for having adolescents be more willing to take risks?
Well, you know, all mammals go through puberty. So we can learn something about human adolescence by looking at the behavior of other animals when they go through this biological change. And when mammals go through puberty, they generally leave the family environment that they've been growing up in search of a mate. And that is a very risky proposition for most young animals because they're competing for mates with bigger and stronger animals. And they often have to go out into the wild without the protection of the adults that have been caring for them. So we think that evolutionarily, adolescence is a time when individuals are biologically wired to be willing to take more risks because it's unlikely that we would be able to reproduce if we didn't take those risks, at least in the time period in which humans evolved.
Lawrence Steinberg is my guest. He is Distinguished University Professor of Psychology at Temple University and author of the new book, Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Today, as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative, we're speaking with Lauren Steinberg, Distinguished University Professor of Psychology at Temple University and author of Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Larry, peer influence has long been something that adults fret over when it comes to adolescence. First of all, why is it that teenagers are more sensitive to what their peers think than they are maybe earlier or later in life?
I think there are a number of reasons for that. Some are simply social, that adolescents spend a lot of time with each other. It's a time when people are starting to date and the time in which they're trying to establish their position in, you know, the social hierarchy of the high school. So, of course, they're paying a lot of attention to what is going on around them. But we also now know from studies of the adolescent brain that a brain system that we often refer to as the social brain undergoes dramatic development during adolescence. So it makes adolescents much more aware of social information, like the expressions on other people's faces, and it makes them much more attentive to it, and it makes them much more responsive to it. So they're more responsive to praise and criticism, especially from peers. One of the focuses of our research at Temple has been on the impact of peers on adolescent risk-taking. I think most of your listeners will know, just from their own personal experiences, that adolescents do many more risky and reckless things when they're with their friends than they would ever do when they're by themselves. I know that was the case for me growing up, and it was the case for my son growing up as well. And we've been looking into this to try to understand exactly what it is that's going on. And we have found some pretty extraordinary things. In a series of experiments we've done, what we have found is that the mere presence of peers activates the reward centers of the brain in adolescents in ways that we don't see in adults. And when these reward centers are activated, it leads adolescents to pay more attention to rewards in their environment and to take more risks in order to get them. So we've done some experiments with a risk-taking task that we developed that mimics a situation that anybody who drives has been in at least once, and that's approaching an intersection and having the light turn yellow just as you get there and having to make a decision about whether you're going to take a chance and run it or not. And when we do studies using this task, what we find is that if adolescents are playing this game and their friends are watching them, not talking to them, not encouraging them, but just merely watching them, even if they're watching from a monitor in another room, adolescents take more risks and they crash the car into oncoming cars more often. Adults play the game the exact same way, whether they're playing it alone or whether they're being watched by their friends. So there is something special about the ways in which peers affect the adolescent brain that leads adolescents to behave very differently when they're in groups than when they're by themselves.
Yeah, reading about that made me think that we should have rules, if not laws. Families might have rules about how many peers, if any, young people can have in the car with them if they are behind the wheel.
You know, many states have what's called graduated driver licensing. I know we have it in Pennsylvania. I'm not sure what the law is like in your part of the country. But in Pennsylvania and in a number of other states, teen drivers are not allowed to have other teen passengers in the car with them until they've accumulated a certain amount of driving experience or until they've reached a certain age. Graduated driver licensing has been one of the most effective and one of the only effective policies that has lowered the teen fatal automobile crash rate. As you probably know, Chris, the automobile crashes are the leading cause of death during adolescence by far. So anything we can do to diminish that is going to be very helpful. We know from the analysis of crash data that with each additional teen passenger in the car, the risk of a teen driver having a crash goes up exponentially. And in fact, if you're an adolescent driver and you're driving with three other kids in the car with you, your risk of having a crash is similar to what it would be if you'd been drinking before you got in the car behind the wheel.
Wow.
I think this is important because I don't know very many parents who would let their teenagers drive after they'd been drinking, but I know plenty of parents who let their teenagers drive with other teenagers in the car. And we need to help parents understand that this is a very risky thing to do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now with Sarah in Richardson. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm excited to be on the program. I guess my question is, I don't disagree with the threats from the risk-taking behavior of teens in driving, but I also think it's really important for teens to learn to drive when they're young, because this is anecdotal, but a lot of the people that I know that learn to drive later are they're not very comfortable drivers. In fact, I would call some of them poor drivers, and it's led me to actually wonder if it's important, if there's some part of the brain that is important for people learning to drive when they are younger and they are elastic and they are willing to take risks, that they become comfortable driving and practice that skill and learn it when they're young. But then I guess maybe the answer is don't drive with so many kids in the car, just do it on your own. But I do feel like it's a good time for kids to learn those motor skills.
Interesting points there, Sarah. Thank you so much. What do you think about all that, Larry?
Well, I think the question raises an interesting broader issue that we should talk about, which is that the plasticity of the adolescent brain is double-edged. It cuts both ways. So the same plasticity that makes it easier to learn things during adolescence also makes it easier to be harmed by toxic experiences in the environment. The data on driving actually contradict a little bit of what the caller has asked about. If you compare teen drivers with adult drivers who have similar levels of experience, so let's say a 16-year-old who's in her first year of driving with a 22-year-old who's in her first year of driving, you do find a greater crash rate among the 16-year-olds. So it isn't just experience. There's something about being young as well. And I do want to point out that we have one of the lowest driving ages in the industrialized world. Most countries don't let people drive until they're 18 years old.
Tell us a little bit about the question of freedom. So many people struggle with how much to watch over their children when they're teenagers, particularly in this era when we've probably been very close to our children for much longer than previous generations would have been.
You know, it's important for parents to monitor their teenagers' activities and to provide developmentally appropriate supervision. And I think that you just have to relax that very gradually as your teenager develops more and more responsibility and the ability to manage his own behavior without you there. We do know that the time between 3 and 6 in the afternoon on weekdays is now the prime time for kids to experiment with drugs and sex and delinquent behavior. And I think one of the things that we ought to be doing as a society is providing more after-school structured supervised activities for teenagers to spend time in so that working parents don't have to worry about their teenagers being unsupervised and just hanging out. And that really turns out to be a recipe for problem behavior. But, at the same time, we don't want to encourage adults to micromanage teenagers in a way that's not going to let teenagers learn how to make independent decisions. So in some senses, it's a fine line that has to be walked. And we don't want to just let teenagers go and let them do whatever they want to do without adults involved in their lives. On the other hand, we want to provide a kind of safe context for kids to engage in independent behavior and even positive risk-taking behavior. Let me just say one more thing about that. We dwell on negative risk-taking behavior because there are the terrible health consequences of things like reckless driving or experimentation with drugs. But I don't think we should adopt the view that all risk-taking is bad and that we don't want adolescents to engage in any risk-taking. We want them to take classes where they're not guaranteed to get A's or go out for the school play or try out for a team that they might not make or even tell somebody that they like, that they like them when they've been nervous about doing it. So the issue is, in my mind, How can we create a world for our adolescents in which they can engage in positive risk-taking, but in which we can protect them from the consequences of negative risk-taking?
You had some fascinating insights here about adolescents' exposure to information. We've long wondered why well-intentioned drug prevention and sex education efforts don't necessarily keep people from doing things we don't want them to do. What can you tell us about that?
Our approach to trying to deter adolescent risky behavior in the United States is mainly through health education, typically delivered in schools. And it's based on the premise that if we explain why something is risky and tell kids what can happen to them and tell them how to protect themselves, that they won't engage in the risk behavior. It turns out that it sounds good in theory, but it's largely ineffective. And evaluations of classroom-based health education show mainly that it's very effective at changing what teenagers know, but it's not very effective at changing how they act. And I call in the book for a shift in our approach to public health involving adolescents that moves away from trying to change kids into something that I think we can't change them into. I think it's an uphill battle against evolution and endocrinology, and instead to try to change the context in which kids grow up. So let me just give you one concrete illustration. We have made much more progress in bringing down the rate of teen smoking by raising the price of cigarettes than we have by educating kids about the dangers of cigarette smoking. And I think in the same way, if we diverted some of the money that we spend on classroom-based health education to providing fun, stimulating, structured, and supervised after-school activities for teenagers, we would do more to reduce experimentation with drugs, alcohol, and sex than any classroom-based education has ever been able to accomplish.
Do the developing brains of teenagers respond differently to chemical substances like drugs and alcohol than fully developed adult brains?
Yes, they do. In fact, exposure to various types of recreational drugs before the age of 15 is 10 times more likely to lead to substance abuse problems and addiction than exposure to the same substances after age 21. Now, we know that this isn't simply because the kinds of people that experiment with drugs when they're young are different in some way, because this research has also been carried out with animals, where they're randomly assigned to either be exposed to these substances when they've just gone through puberty or to hold off and not be exposed to them until they're fully mature adults. And it does have a different effect on the brains of animals, depending upon the age of exposure. And that goes back to this issue of brain plasticity. The parts of the brain that respond to these drugs are still developing and still maturing during the early part of adolescence. And when we put drugs into that brain system, it permanently affects the way that system responds to these substances, and it very much increases the likelihood of an addiction.
So some people might imagine that the solution for this is to kind of really sit on kids and make the rules very, very harsh. But you, in fact, really endorse the authoritative rather than authoritarian style of parenting. Can you help us understand the difference between them?
Sure. Authoritative parenting is a label that psychologists use to refer to a type of parenting that combines both firmness and warmth. And you really need to put the two of them together. So if you're a parent and you're warm and loving, but you're not very firm, you don't really enforce rules, maybe you don't even have them, you raise your child in a very permissive fashion, that's going to place your child at risk for all kinds of problem behavior. If you raise your child in a way that is very firm but not very warm, kind of like tiger mothering, frankly, you're going to place your child at risk for different kinds of emotional problems like depression. So you really need to do both of these in combination, be warm and be firm at the same time. And that helps adolescents internalize your rules and expectations, but it also gives them the confidence and the competence to behave responsibly when they're by themselves.
Do you find that parents have the ability to sort of deliberately choose a parenting style, or does this take work? And how aware are most people of what kind of parent they are?
I've studied this for, nearly 40 years. Most parents parent the way they do because they think it's the right way to parent. We've rarely met a parent who parents kind of in a random fashion. They might be wrong about their assumptions about what their parenting does, but they're rarely doing it without thinking about it at all. That said, the kind of parenting that experts recommend, this authoritative parenting, is harder to do. It's more time-consuming than to be either permissive or autocratic. You know, the easiest thing in the world is to always say yes or to always say no. Mm-hmm. It's much harder to take the time to explain yourself and to deliver these expectations in a way that's warm and involved and loving. And, you know, it's also a lot easier to do that when you don't live under a great deal of stress. So we know that when parents live under stressful situations, it does undermine the quality of their parenting, and it makes some of them excessively permissive, and it makes others excessively autocratic.
Besides filling their developing brains up with education, Larry, what kinds of experiences do we want adolescents to have so that they will grow into the best possible adults?
In the book, I talk a lot about the importance of developing self-control. Of all the traits that a person can have in life, strong self-control is arguably the single most important one. There have been literally hundreds of studies that show that adolescents who can exercise strong self-control, who have very good self-regulation, as psychologists would call it, do better in school, they have better relationships, they're happier, they're less prone to emotional and behavioral problems. So a lot of people, like myself, have been studying what can we do to help instill stronger self-control in our young people. And there are some interesting findings emerging from this new research that show how to do this and that actually have identified the ways in which the brain is changed by them. So one of them that's very important is mindfulness. And mindfulness meditation is an important contributor. Another is aerobic exercise. So those are two things that parents ought to be encouraging in their kids.
We're speaking this hour with Lauren Steinberg, Distinguished University Professor of Psychology at Temple University and author of Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Lauren Steinberg, Distinguished University Professor of Psychology at Temple University and author of Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Aiden, who writes, "Have you observed any relationship between initiation rites in primitive cultures and the change in behavior as people reach psychological adulthood? That is, in reaching adulthood at a certain age through initiation rites compared to our society that has vague initiation rites?"
Yeah, good question. I think we really don't know the answer to that because most of the studies of initiation rites have not looked at psychological development as a function of them. I think that there is the perception, that the sense that the clarity of the transition to adulthood that takes place in societies where there's an obvious initiation rite is good for kids, whereas in modern society, it's hard to know when you're an adult. And it's been hypothesized for a long time that the clarity of it in less developed cultures makes it easier to become a psychological adult. We simply don't know the answer to that. I can say that I don't see any evidence that the delayed transition into adulthood that's characteristic of the United States and many other industrialized countries today is hurting people in any way. We've looked at this using a large data set to look to see whether there's a relationship between psychological well-being and the age at which people enter the labor force, become married, become parents, become economically independent. And these are largely uncorrelated. If anything, delaying these transitions seems to be better for psychological health than doing them at an earlier age. One of the arguments that I make in the book is that there's reason to think that taking a little bit longer to get through adolescence actually might be good for your brain as well. It might keep the brain plastic for a longer period of time.
We have a tweet here from Matthew who wants to know how adolescence was different in previous generations when essentially children were moved right from childhood into adulthood.
Well, that really never took place. Mm. There's always been a period of time that has been recognized as a transitional phase between childhood and adulthood. So even though in the United States, couple centuries ago, people started working at an earlier age. They weren't considered adults, and they worked in capacities that were specifically designed and more suitable for adolescents. Even when adolescents left home, they didn't live on their own. They often were living with other families in the community in kind of a semi-independent phase. So this idea that adolescence hasn't existed until recently is really not the case.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Jerry on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I was curious to know what the professor has learned about instilling self-esteem in developing children. Is low self-esteem just in the air because of what the parents are, or is that something that can be identified and they can actually, with the kindness and the, like he was saying, teach this to children so that their lives will be better? And I'll take my answer off the phone.
Thanks for your call.
So self-esteem is something that is affected by how somebody is raised. So children who grow up with the kinds of parents we were talking about before, who are warm and firm, typically score higher on measures of self-esteem than children who are raised either permissively, but especially higher than children who are raised in a more autocratic, dictatorial fashion. But self-esteem also comes from accomplishment. I think for a long time, it was erroneously believed that by raising kids' self-esteem kind of artificially, we would boost their achievement and boost their performance. That turns out not to be true. What is true, however, is that by giving kids the skills to perform well and rewarding them for performing well, then children's self-esteem improves as a function of that.
So we want to help them develop self-discipline. Sometimes that involves parents disciplining their adolescents. What works and what doesn't to get to the behavior we want and also to get the message through that a certain kind of behavior is expected or is not acceptable?
Well, I think rule number one is that a parent needs to explain the logic behind his or her expectations and rules. The do-it-because-I-said-so approach to discipline might work with a 4 or 5-year-old, probably not even then too well, frankly. It might work with younger children, but it certainly doesn't work with teenagers. In my experience, adolescents are much more likely to comply with their parents' expectations and rules if they understand the logic behind them and if they understand why it's in their best interest to do that. So that's number one. Number two is that it's important to be consistent. You can't discipline a child on Tuesday and then throw that rule out the window on Thursday because you're too tired to apply it. And it's very difficult to discipline adolescents if you and your partner don't agree. So it is important to have a united front when having rules and expectations and to be consistent from day to day. And then finally, it doesn't work to punish adolescents harshly. So we know that physical punishment, corporal punishment, is largely ineffective and has some actually harmful consequences. We know that screaming and yelling is not very effective and can have some harmful consequences as well. So a sort of reasoned approach to discipline tends to work much more with adolescents. Adolescents also, it turns out, are much more responsive to rewards than to punishments. And so it's always a better strategy, if you can do this, to reward good behavior rather than to punish bad behavior.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Eddie on the line in Dallas. Hi, Eddie.
Hi. It's a great show. Thank you very much for this information. Two quick questions. I know you study adolescents for the most part, but do you have a view on the Adrian Peterson controversy around the spanking and switching, et cetera, particularly as it may relate to the cultural differences between urban African-American communities and others? And then for adolescent males, have you done much specific study on urban African-American adolescent males? Because there's a great deal of interest in the community about doing something specifically to address at-risk adolescent African-American youth. And I will take my answers offline.
Thanks for your call.
I think that we need to distinguish between an approach to raising children that is culturally acceptable within a certain community versus what the impact of that practice is. Actually, I'm involved in this study around the world, which I mentioned earlier, and we are looking specifically at whether physical punishment, spanking and hitting kids, has a different impact on their development in different cultures. And we find that it doesn't. It really is pretty universally bad for kids. So even though this might be a more accepted practice within the urban African-American community, it still doesn't make it any good for kids to do it. They don't benefit from it, even if it's accepted. I have been very involved in research on urban African-American males, because, as your listeners probably know, African-American boys and young men are disproportionately likely to be caught up in the juvenile and criminal justice systems. And one area of research that I've been involved in for a long time now is in trying to establish saner and more effective juvenile justice policies and practices. I'm also involved in some research that is we're doing in Chicago, actually in the Chicago schools, to try to help develop self-control and self-regulation among poor African-American adolescents, because a lot of them have been raised in environments in which those skills have not been fostered very well, either because they were raised in places where they were exposed to trauma and violence, or because they grew up in poverty and that led their parents to be exceptionally harsh or inconsistent. And all those things are not good for the brain, and they do undermine the development of brain systems that lead to better self-control. So, I think the bottom line is that all kids, regardless of their race and regardless of their ethnicity, regardless of their family income, need the same things. I mean, they need adults in their life who are warm and loving and firm. And that recipe has been shown to work across people from all walks of life.
Speaking of recipes, what is it that happens at those family dinners that turns out to be so protective in so many ways?
I think it's the spending time together, and time together where in healthy families there's genuine conversation. A lot of parents say to me, well, I try to get my adolescent to talk to me, but she doesn't ever want to say anything. And I ask her how things are going, and she just says, okay. She gives me a one-word answer. And if you look a little bit deeper at that, what you often find is that adolescents don't like it when they feel that their parents are just asking them these questions just for the sake of asking or because they're spying on them. Mm-hmm. And when they believe that their parents don't have a genuine interest in how they're doing or what they're doing. So I think that family dinner time can be a very important time when people can have longer conversations that aren't simply limited to how was your day today in school or tell me what you did this afternoon, where you can talk about things like what's going on in the news or how your day was at work or a problem that you confronted with your coworkers and how you solved it. And you can ask your adolescent's advice about how you might have handled it differently. adolescents love to have conversations in which they're treated in a mature and respectful way. And you would really be surprised at how many parents don't understand it or don't do it.
You push back here a little bit against the idea that we need to get as many kids as possible into college, because when we do that, sometimes we lose focus on the fact that they need to be prepared to succeed in college. And you say not just academically, but also psychologically. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So if you look internationally, what you see is that we have one of the highest college enrollment rates in the world. So we do a very good job of getting people to go to college. Where we're terrible is getting them to graduate from college. We are actually tied for last in the developed world in the rate of college completion. That is the percentage of people who start college who actually get a college degree. And 1/3 of all students who enroll in college never get a college degree. So even though our politicians are talking about the need to enroll more people in college, and I understand where that's coming from, because as I said before, you do need a college degree to get a decent job. If we don't do something to equip young people with the skills to be able to succeed in college and to complete college, then all we'll be doing is educating partially a larger number of people who leave university with student debt and aren't any more competitive in the labor force. A lot of experts are now asking about what schools can do to build what they're calling non-cognitive skills. These are things like perseverance and determination and grit. And as I explain in the book, and I've written about elsewhere, we don't demand very much from our high school students. And as a consequence, we don't push them in ways that are good for their brain. We don't challenge them in ways that are going to help develop better self-regulation, more determination, and the ability to, I think, ultimately go to college and be prepared academically as well as psychologically for the demands of being independent and in higher education.
So we actually need to make high school more challenging and let them know that we have made it more challenging.
It really is striking. I came across a statistic that I find very worrisome, which is that only 1 out of every 6 American high school students says that she's ever taken a difficult class. Huh. Only 1 out of 6 ever, one difficult class. And in these international achievement competitions where we read about in the paper how American high school students fare so poorly, they often administer attitudinal questionnaires to the samples of kids from around the world. In 1 year, they asked kids to indicate how boring high school was. And we were near the top of the world in ratings of our schools as boring. 70% of American high school students say in surveys that they would learn more in school if their schools had higher standards. So I think it would be actually welcome by our teenagers to make schools more interesting, more challenging, and more demanding. And we would see a lot of payoff in how people performed when they graduated from high school and entered into college.
Lawrence Steinberg is Distinguished University Professor of Psychology at Temple University. His latest book is Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. Larry, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and Lindsay Kinect. Our engineer today was Alan Roberts. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.